World Food Program saving lives. But if we are saving the same life again and again and again, it's a structural problem. We need to do something different. We need to change lives. And that's not going to happen overnight.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. COVID, Ukraine, Gaza, climate change, demographic change. All of these crises underline the need for humanitarian relief, and that need is at record highs, while support from the international community, well, that's dwindling. Most development research today focuses on creating sustainable growth, but could we put more priority on the most efficient policies to deliver urgently needed humanitarian assistance? And if we did, what would those policies be? Arif Hussein, the UN World Food Programme's chief economist, sees at first hand the need to improve global food security and the inadequacy of the international response, and he joins me now. Arif, you were one of our very first guests on Vox Dev Talks, so I'm delighted to talk to you again. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Arif, I mentioned that the need for humanitarian support is huge. Can you put some numbers on that and tell me, in 2024, are those numbers getting bigger or smaller?
Well, just to put things in perspective, at the time right before COVID, end of 2019, we had about 135 million people in the world who were in hunger crises or worse situation. Mm-hmm. And that was in about 52, 53 countries worldwide. Then COVID struck, and suddenly that 135 became about 276 million. And instead of 52, 53 countries, we went up to about 78, 79 countries. And then COVID stayed with us for a couple of years. And after that, the war in Ukraine basically picked that 276 and took it up to 345 million people in 22. For 23, we have pretty much stayed at that level for most of the year in about, again, 78, 79 countries. Right now, as we speak, we're looking at about 333 million people in 79 countries who are in crisis or worse level of food security situations. But that's just half of the story. So you can say that, look, I mean, you know, food security numbers, they're stabilizing, but they're stabilizing at very elevated levels. Mm-hmm. But what is tough is that our monies are shrinking. In 2022, we were at a record level, which was about $14.2 billion. Mm-hmm. And in 2023, we fell to about $8.6 billion.
Wow.
And that is a 60% cut or more, which is frankly unsustainable. So another way you can say this is that, you know, our needs have stabilized at post-COVID, post-Ukraine levels, but our funding has fallen back to pre-COVID level. And that is something which is terrible. The consequences of that could be felt around the world. Let me also be clear about one other thing, that World Food Program, it's a voluntarily funded organization. Mm-hmm. Our biggest funders are donor governments, big governments, you know, 90+%, and then private sector, and then individual givings. But the main thrust is governments. We have always had a gap of about 30% in terms of what we asked for, meaning, you know, what we needed, mm-hmm. and what we actually got. And by one way or the other, we have been able to manage that. But a 60+% gap is unmanageable. And that has both direct consequences and indirect consequences.
How do you make priority with such a huge gap when everything you do is important?
That's the toughest part of the job, really.
Yeah.
Because you're choosing between hungry and the starving. And you're giving food to the starving while you know others are hungry. And what happens is that pretty soon those who are hungry become starving. So you get caught in this cycle. When you have a 30% gap, one way or the other, you're able to manage it. But at 60% of the gap, it is practically impossible. Mm-hmm. So what are we doing? Pretty much everywhere, we are cutting rations. We are cutting the number of people we are assisting and massively cutting those down. Or instead of giving them a full ration, we are maybe giving them half ration. And even then, doing all of that, we got a big gap. Mm-hmm. And I will say it again, that this gap has consequences not only to the people who are suffering and starving, but it has consequences to the rest of the economy and also rest of the world. We need to take that part in our calculus when we are trying to answer and address these questions collectively, whether, you know, you're a humanitarian, whether you're sitting in the government, whether you're a politician, because it is a collective problem. And above all, the days of saying it is somebody else's problem or it is something, it's over there, we got our problems over here, are long gone. We are too tightly knitted to see things happening elsewhere as somebody else's problem. They may be somebody else's problems right now, but very quickly they become our problems. And then we end up spending billions upon billions of dollars to sort that out. And I think that's something which policymakers, politicians, decision makers need to understand better.
We'll look at some solutions or some potential solutions to this in a minute. But just before we get off this, why has the funding dropped off so much? Is it donor fatigue? Is it different political priorities? What's going on?
At the end of the day, it is donor fatigue, right? Because mm-hmm. in the world, it's funny you say that, but there are only so many resources.
Yeah.
And there are prioritization decisions. And when anything happens, those prioritization decisions change. The war in Ukraine wasn't cheap. Dealing with COVID isn't cheap. Now dealing with Gaza is not going to be cheap. Mm-hmm. So if all of these things are happening, where the money is coming from? And something has to give. Unfortunately, many times that something which has to give becomes humanitarian assistance, mm-hmm. which is, at least in my mind, this is never the best decision. Why? Because it just means that you're delaying the problem. Mm-hmm. And like any disease, if you don't address it up front, when it's only a symptom, a few months later, a couple of years later, it festers into something way more serious. Mm-hmm. And it is no different in this work.
Policy often has this distinction between a humanitarian response and development policies to encourage growth, and they have separate budgets. Is this inevitable? Is this problematic?
This is a pretty basic fundamental question. And the answer is quite simple. When we say, you know what, this is the humanitarian or this is the development window, we are essentially talking monies. Mm-hmm. But the people are the same. When you're looking at people, when you're dealing with the people, it doesn't matter where the money came from, as long as it comes for the right reason and for the right purpose and at the right time. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, let me give you an example. You may have a situation where there is a village which is going to get flooded, but you have only humanitarian money. So you cannot use that money to build a levee so the village doesn't get flooded. But when it does get flooded, you can help people out. Mm-hmm. Look, guys, it doesn't really matter whether it is your development income stream or your humanitarian income stream. Bottom line is you're talking about the same people in the same place. Let's bring them together and do what is necessary, whether it is development work, whether it is recovery work, whether it is humanitarian work, and get it done so we don't waste resources. And above all, we don't waste resilience of people. You know, everybody deals with shocks, right? But what makes chronic poverty, what makes people really, really poor? That is when somebody experiencing a shock has to lose their productive economic assets, mm-hmm. has to sell those productive economic assets, which they used to use to make money. Now, it could be in Somalia or in Ethiopia and elsewhere, it could be livestock. Or for an electrician, it could be a drill. Because when they sell that, it takes them ages to have insufficient resources to get back into the economic stream. So as humanitarians, as development actors, as recovery actors, whatever label you want to put up, what you want to make sure is that you help people before they're forced mm-hmm. to sell their productive economic assets. That is really, really, really critically important when it comes to policy. Early warning, early action, so we can allow people to not be in that space.
Officials in Pakistan say flash floods across much of the country have killed over 1,000 people and displaced thousands more since mid-June. The newest fatalities are primarily being reported in the northwest and down in southern Sindh province. Weeks of unrelenting monsoon rains have affected more than 30 million people.
Arif, every morning you wake up with a challenge to do more with less. Well, much more with much less, as you've described it. What sits behind that is a choice of actions, an unpalatable choice, but one that has to be made anyway. Do we know enough rigorously about what are the best policies? Is the research base, which I note for humanitarian assistance, is much smaller than it is for other areas of development. Is that research base big enough? Are there important things we don't know yet?
In broad strokes, we know enough.
Mm-hmm.
We have a very clear idea of the problem statement. We have a very clear idea of what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
I would go as far as saying, maybe we even have the money to actually do that.
We do.
If you repurpose all the money which goes into agricultural sector, if you repurpose all the money which goes for subsidies, I mean, you're talking in hundreds of billions of dollars, right? So money may not be sitting there, but it could be repurposed. So you know the problem, you know what needs to be done, you have the technology, and you say you even have the money, so why doesn't it happen? And the answer, frankly, is that in order for these things to happen, you need political will. And you need to stay the course, because these things cannot be solved in a day or two or a month or a year. And this is where we lack. We don't have that political will. We don't have that ability to stay the course, to get everything done. We talk about it when there is a crisis,
mm-hmm.
and then we get onto that, and then the crisis goes up, and we go back. And I think that's something which needs to stop, because our frequency of crisis is increasing. The second thing for me on the policy side, what is important is we need to increase the opportunity sets of people.
Mm-hmm.
If I put you in a situation where many of the people we help live, or if I put myself in that situation, I will pretty much be doing the same thing they are doing.
Mm-hmm.
When I say improve their opportunity sets, it means investments in things like rural infrastructure, the roads. You and I cannot build roads, but if the road is there, we can do better. We can start markets. Our distances shrink. All of that improves, right? We need irrigation. I cannot build a dam, but if the dam was there, I don't need to be fed.
Mm-hmm.
We need electrification. If those type of basic infrastructure was available, which in my mind creates the space for people to utilize opportunities,
mm-hmm.
suddenly things start to change. And I'm not just saying this. I can tell you example after example where we cleared the road because we had to move food, and we suddenly see markets spring up or health centers become closer or distances shrink and trade starts to happen. So we know what needs to be done. The other thing is, for me, we are sitting in Western countries. Whenever there is a recession, what do? We give tax credit to the poorest households in our economies. Why do we do that? Because we know those individuals are going to spend that money, which will mm-hmm. generate growth, which will generate jobs. And the idea is that it reignites the economies, whether in the US or UK or elsewhere, right? Why is it any different in rural areas of Africa? It's not. You put in money in the grassroots. If people have the money to buy, somebody will come to sell. But they will only come to sell if there are the roads. So it's not saying, oh, we don't know what to do. Of course we know what to do. But it will only happen if there is political will, if there is better governance, if there is coordinated response. All those words, they have meaning. Look at Burundi and Rwanda, mid-90s. Same number of people, same socioeconomic indicators, same levels of life expectancy. Today, one is pretty high on the development trajectory. The other one is pretty much where it was 20 years down the road. Why? Political stability, investment in women, investment in children, investment in infrastructure, and relatively better governance. I don't buy the argument that we don't know what to do. I think we do, but we need to stay the course to get these things done. The World Food Program is saving lives. But if we are saving the same life again and again and again, it's a structural problem. We need to do something different. We need to change lives. And that's not going to happen overnight.
Arif, one of the things that gets in the way of that structural transformation, even with policies that we know would work and make people more productive, is indebtedness. Is there some way that we can wrap up the international community's attitude to debt with the sorts of policies that you are recommending?
This is music to my ears, to be honest with you. Over 60% of low and lower middle income countries are either at risk or actually in debt distress. There are about 23 countries which spend more on their debt servicing than on their education sector. There are about 50 plus countries which spend more on their debt servicing than on their health and education sectors combined. If we can have debt relief for environment, why can't we not have debt relief for better food security, for building human capital? Think about this. If you say, debt relief for environment, and you plant a tree can be cut. If you say debt relief for food security or for building human capital, that cannot be cut. That will pay dividends now and later. Whether you do it through bonds, whether you do it through any other financial mechanism, debt relief conditional on investment in human capital can go a long way.
You mentioned climate change. We have done many episodes talking about the unequal impact of climate change on the world's poorest people, and especially the ultra-poor, the people who you are most concerned with. Can we wrap up our policies for climate change with, again, the sorts of policies you want to deliver? How does it affect how you're thinking about the future of the World Food Programme?
COP28 was encouraging in that sense. Governments talked about some of the financing. Because at the end of the day, it is both a business argument as well as it's a moral argument, right? That countries, especially small countries, which have not necessarily contributed to the situation where we are right now, are having to pay that price. Mm-hmm. So how can now the countries which have benefited kind of compensate those countries who have already paid the price? I mean, classic example of that, look at Pakistan, 2022, where a third of the country was damage is worth $30 billion, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. How can that be compensated? And the issue that this is something which if we don't address, everybody will pay the price, the rich and the poor. The problem is that the poor don't have the resources to pay the price either. So they are more heavily discounted than the rich. But it is something which we shouldn't be saying, do it for the poor. Do it for ourselves. But by the way, while you're doing this, the poorest countries are suffering the most because of no fault of their own. So let's take care of them as well while we are doing this. That's what this is all about.
There has been a lot of research on the problems of creating growth in conflict situations. Those problems are even more acute, I would imagine, in providing humanitarian assistance. Is what we are learning from those being applied? Is there a better way in which we can deliver assistance in conflict-affected areas?
You have cause and effect. Till you address the cause, you have to deal with the effect. And I think that's absolutely the case in humanitarian assistance. I mean, I'll give the example that, look, a war started, 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. When it started, people were in a better state than they would be now. Why? Because they've been dealing with it for the last 3 years. So they're coping, their resources they have depleted over this time. But our models, it started, let's say war or earthquake or landslide or whatever. Yep. Let's give assistance because it just happened. Everybody out there. 6 months later, everybody has forgotten about it. But the effects have not gone away because the cause is still there. When something happens, you must address the root causes. And till you address those root causes, you need to help people. You need to assist people. Look at Yemen. Look at Syria. Mm-hmm. These crises, I mean, they're getting to 10 years plus range now. Why should there be no need in these places if the war is still continuing? When somebody says to me, oh, please reduce needs, I'm like, you show me a place where things have been sorted out and needs will automatically come down. But don't say reduce needs if the initial cause is still there.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, as implementers, as providers of aid, can we be more efficient? We can always be more efficient. New technologies, new ways of doing things. I mean, efficiencies in terms of maybe sometimes cash is way better than food. In other places, food is way better than cash, depending on the context. Better understanding of that context. But Tim, the issue is that when we look at the gaps that we have right now, we're not going to sort those out by improving our efficiencies. Because at the end of the day, efficiencies are in the sense of how we provide a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
And the bulk of the cost is the benefit itself, right? So you can do your efficiency in single-digit cents mm-hmm. in terms of percentage, but the bulk that you're going to provide is still going to cost. That you cannot shrink.
The government has spent billions of dollars on this state-of-the-art aircraft carrier. Where Britain used to lead the way in supporting the world's most vulnerable people, the government's now under fire for slashing its foreign aid budget by $5.5 billion.
So if we have to take a step back and reassess not just how we deliver assistance, but what we do, the whole strategy to do it, that has got to be something that's taken on by the international community working together. In what forum does this happen? And how do we make sure that the evidence that we have, what we know about what works best, is included in that discussion?
All you have to do is look back. After World War II, for example, there were many countries were totally destroyed. Frankly, most of today's G7 countries were countries which were totally decimated after World War II. How did they become G7 countries? How did they become top economies of the world? The recipe is there, right? And you don't even have to just take World War II. You can even take Korea a bit later. And then I can give you a couple more examples. And you can even, if you want to go in terms of, you know, not conflict, not war, but just development, look at China, mm-hmm. bringing poverty down from 70-80% to less than 1%, 2%. In 40 years. So my point is, it has been done before, so there is hope. But for this to happen, it requires everybody to actually be focusing on a particular place, a particular country. And that development plan needs to be executed. Whenever that is done, you have seen that countries have gotten onto the development trajectory and did quite well. For me, I mean, it always like, okay, you know what, when you're losing hope because you're seeing all of this, you need to look back and say, you know what, there were times before when people must have felt the way you are feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then we saw them get out of there. We have the technology, we have the resources, we have the know-how. It really, truly is a matter of political will and commitment to get it done. We are very trained to ask, okay, how much is it going to cost on a project? Oh, I want to do this project. Okay, how much is it going to cost? I think we need to start turning that question on its head and basically saying, you know, somebody comes to you and say, I want to do this. And you ask them, so what will happen if I don't? And then if the answer scares you, you better do it.
Mm-hmm.
And if the answer doesn't scare you, you say, oh, this can wait. I've got other priorities. But at least look at it from the angle of what if you don't? And I think in this world right now, if we started asking that question, maybe our politicians and maybe our policymakers will be doing things a bit differently than they've been doing so far. Because there is a cost of inaction. It's just that we don't calculate that properly. Let me give you some numbers on this. The Syrian refugees 5-6 years ago, when they went to 1 million to Germany,
mm-hmm.
in the 5 years from 2016 to 2021, the federal government alone spent about $125 billion on that 1 million refugees. Apples to apples, if the same benefits were provided in Lebanon or in Jordan, where these people, by the way, wanted to stay, same religion, same culture, it would have cost them 70 times less. We did the math, we published all of this. Look at Central America and the U.S. The people who are moving or trying to come into the U.S. from Central America, most of them are coming from the poorest counties of those countries, most food insecure and poor. So if we're going to spend money to keep them out, we might as well spend money where they are so they don't have to leave in the very first place. There is this fallacy that everybody wants to leave their home and go to Western Europe or go to the US. I don't think that's true, because if that was true, population of migrants would be more than 3% of the global population. Yet migrants are only 3% of the global population. You ask your own family and your own friends, wherever they are, just look, how many have moved? And chances are you will see, at least in my case, that we are the outliers who have moved. Most of the people are where they were. This is a reality which is common across the entire world. Help people where they are. Given the choice, they'd rather stay where they are and have a decent life than make these hard, tough journeys to unknown places, taking big risks. Whether on the Mediterranean, passing through Sahara, knowing that you may be enslaved in Libya, but you still do it. And you do it not only for yourself, but together with your families. How bad things have to be where you are for somebody who's a rational thinker to make those choices.
Every week on Vox Dev Talks, I speak to smart people who work incredibly hard and produce amazing results and often wonderful outcomes in individual projects in places around the globe. And yet, I talk to you, and compared to the last time we spoke 5 years ago, you are pushing an even bigger rock up an even bigger hill. And if you sometimes lose hope?
If I lost hope, I won't get up.
Yeah.
You can, because you are the voice of people who have no voice. The vast majority of people are decent individuals, human beings, who want to do the right thing, who don't want to see suffering. That's the majority, right? But we are all caught up in our own lives. Sometimes the job is just to connect the dots and say, look, who you're talking to, they are no different than you are. And the only probably different is you were born in one place and they were born in another place. But that's it. If you were there in that circumstance, you will probably be doing the same thing. Our collective role is to improve the lives of the less fortunate. And I think we can do that. What is the worst kind of inequality? For me, that is inequality in opportunity. Because if you have that opportunity, then you can reach for the moon. If I have the opportunity, I can overcome income inequality. Inequality in humanitarian assistance. If I have the opportunity, I don't need humanitarian assistance. So for me, this is why investing in public infrastructure, things which people cannot do by themselves, back to roads, back to irrigation, back to electrification, these are investments which minimize inequality and opportunity. And that's what we need to do. And people will do the rest.
Arif Hussain, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you want to know more about the inspiring work of the World Food Programme, then look on the internet, wfp.org. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe on your podcast platform. Wherever you get your podcasts, you will find us there. And our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org.